I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and they're off in the final sprint to the midterm elections. President Obama is on the road this week, pushing new economic proposals and trying to reverse the negative polling showing Democrats at risk of losing control of Congress. The president was in Milwaukee yesterday during a speech before union members. He passionately reiterated the White House line that Republicans are obstructionists, that Republicans drove the economy into a ditch and are now standing around while Democrats try to dig it out. But the president added a twist when he said Republicans weren't happy that he'd taken on special interests.
Some powerful interests who had been dominating the agenda in Washington for a very long time, and they're not always happy with me. They talk about me like a dog. That's not in my prepared remarks, but it's true.
Let's check in with Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News, host of the political webcast Top Line. Rick, that was a pretty powerful moment yesterday. Your thoughts, first of all.
First of all, that wasn't in the prepared text. That was President Obama ad-libbing as he went along. And he's certainly grown frustrated by the way that he's characterized by a lot of folks on the right. And I think this is one display of that frustration. But also that tone that he's taken of sort of mocking the other side, saying they would just want to say no to me, and there's a personal hatred that animates them. I think that's a major tone from the president and from Democrats more generally as they try to portray this campaign as a choice between the parties, not a referendum on the president's leadership.
Well, and there was something particularly striking about seeing the country's first black president utter those words. I mean, again,
right.
It seemed like a powerful moment. However, I'm not sure how many Americans saw it on Labor Day.
Well, that's a good point. I think, though, we're going to see a lot more intense campaigning over the next couple of months. But clearly, the idea of the opposition just digging in against the president, doing anything they can to stop him, to block him, to mock him, is something that Democrats are going to be doing their best to push back against this fall.
Well, Politico writes that the president might get some sympathy from his, quote, lethargic, downcast base, end quote, by acknowledging that he's constantly under fire. But what about the proposals? First of all, he proposed yesterday $50 billion for infrastructure spending, Republicans casting this as a stimulus, the White House saying they'll pay for it by eliminating huge tax breaks for the oil industry. But do you think it's resonating?
There's no sign that it is right now. There's a couple of different things that are going on right now. The president knows he has to do many things to help the economy and help the economy grow, but there's only very few things that can get done in this kind of polarized political climate. And there's even fewer things that can actually make a difference over these next 8 weeks. Realistically, there's no big things. There's no silver bullets, as the president said yesterday, that can turn things around quickly enough for it to make a difference in the elections.
Well, as we said last week, the president's trying to hammer home that there's a stalled jobs bill that would help small businesses. Republicans say it's spending money and they're against it. The president again saying that it's not spending money, that it'll be deficit neutral. And the president's going to Cleveland tomorrow, where he's going to call on Congress to approve new tax breaks for businesses. What will these breaks do?
The new breaks would allow businesses to more quickly write off research and development, be able to invest more fully and get a tax break for it in the short term. This is something that has been in place in various forms for 30 years or so, and businesses cite this as something that's important to them to take away the uncertainty. One of the problems, though, is anything that spends money these days, the president knows that you have to spend money to help the economy, but that just feeds into the Republican argument right now. The Democrats are championing runaway spending. So it just complicates that political agenda over these next 8 weeks.
Well, and complicating the agenda even more, the week ends with the 9/11 anniversary. And the pastor, Terry Jones, of the Dove World Outreach Center in Gainesville, Florida, is calling for it to be Burn the Koran Day. He wants Christians to burn a Koran on 9/11. Top military leader General David Petraeus saying that will put Americans in harm's way around the world. Today, Jones Church released a statement saying it's time for America to quit apologizing for our actions and bowing to kings. He's going ahead with this day. Rick, how dangerous is this politically for Republicans? You have left-leaning blogs like Politicus USA writing the inflammatory and inaccurate Fox/Republican Party created this drama, ginned it up over Park 51. That's the proposed Islamic Cultural Center in New York. And they're saying Republicans own this issue.
Wow, yes. I think that's one of the many issues that will face Republicans with this, is that they've driven this issue over the proposed mosque and cultural center in Lower Manhattan. They've made it into a political issue. I think it'll be interesting to watch them and also moderate Christian voices about their reaction, particularly when you have folks like General Petraeus talking about this as a national security issue. This isn't just religious statements. These are things that could have an impact on troops on the ground. So I do think this has the potential still to be a political issue. We haven't seen it kind of metastasize into that yet, but it can certainly get there if things like this continue to happen.
Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News, host of the political webcast Top Line. Here we go. Just a few weeks to the midterms. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, home sales in July were down by more than 25% from the previous year, a drop that coincided with the end of the home buyer tax credit. And there's a debate now about whether the Obama administration should reinstitute that credit. But there's also a debate about whether people should even be encouraged to buy homes. Yes, home building jumpstarts other sectors. But does buying a home necessarily mean the purchaser is on the road to a big payoff? According to an annual survey taken by economists Robert Shiller and Carl Case, hundreds of new homeowners say they still think home prices will rise sharply. They think it's a law of nature. And all presidents for decades have said home ownership is better for owners and for communities. But as we've seen, home prices don't continue to rise under some law of nature. And now economists like Stan Humphries of the real estate website Zillow are warning owning a home may no longer be the way to build long-term wealth. Well, James Kwok says it never really was. Kwok is co-author with economist Simon Johnson of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. And in a recent post on the Economy blog, The Baseline Scenario, Kwok wrote, "The era of your home as a cash cow never existed." He joins us from the studios of WFCR-FM in Amherst, Massachusetts. So, James, make your case. Because you say even your father saw his home value rise over the last two decades. So explain your thinking.
If you look at the data compiled by Robert Shiller, perhaps our country's leading housing economist, it shows that for most of the second half of the 20th century, housing went up by about 1% per year after inflation. So that's not very much. It's certainly less than stocks. It's less than U.S. government bonds, which are completely risk-free or essentially risk-free. And when you buy a house, not only are you putting a lot of money in one asset class, residential housing, but you're putting a lot of money in one specific asset, which could certainly go down by a lot of money. So even if housing as a whole in the country is going up, your house could lose value. Just to take a very simple example, you could be subject to a flood, and most people don't have flood insurance. So a house is a risky asset, and most of the time it doesn't provide very good returns to compensate for that risk.
By the way, we have economist Robert Shiller's graph, and we'll post it on our website, and I'm looking at it right now, and sure enough, you know, starting in 1890, you know, the housing values inch up a little bit, but all of a sudden you come to 2000 to 2010, and there's a huge spike up, and then poof, a corresponding drop down, and we know that a lot of the increase in home value there was because of the buying and reselling of mortgages and the inflating of their value by people who wanted to buy and sell them over and over again. But as we said, it feels that if our parents, let's say, bought their homes in the 50s, 60s, or 70s, they did make a lot of money selling them. Those homes were worth a lot more if they sold them in the 90s.
Well, it's certainly true that you can make a lot of money from housing for a few reasons. And many people have made a lot of money or think they've made a lot of money, and that's why there is this conventional wisdom that for a long time a house was a great way to accumulate wealth. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is what I call price illusion, which is that you buy a house, you typically hold on to it for a long time. So let's say you pay $300,000 for a house, you sell it for $600,000 20 years later, you feel like you've made $300,000. Most of that is just inflation. Another big reason is leverage. So if you buy a house, it's the only time that a bank will loan you hundreds of thousands of dollars for most of us. It's the only way you can get somebody to loan you hundreds of thousands of dollars, even if your net worth is quite small. Your net worth could be $50,000. You could borrow $500,000. You know, if you have 10 times leverage, it means that if your house goes up in value by 10%, you will double your money. At the same time, it means that if your house goes down by 10%, you will lose all of your capital, and then it starts having non-financial impacts, because if your house is underwater and there are more than 10 million households today that are underwater, it can affect your ability to move. For example, if you can't sell your house for enough to pay off your mortgage, you can't move. That means you might not be able to move to someplace to get a new job. that can lead to long-term unemployment and all sorts of problems that go beyond your investment portfolio itself.
Well, in fact, Time Magazine, a recent cover was Rethinking Home Ownership, Why Owning a Home May No Longer Make Economic Sense, and they start right off the gate with a family that needs to get a better job. There's no employment. They found a terrific job in another area, but they can't sell their house without taking a huge loss because they are underwater. The house is worth less than they owe on it. So
exactly.
This is happening more and more, and they make the case in Time Magazine, quoting real estate experts, that in fact rental housing provides so much more mobility, allows people to move and take jobs.
Exactly. There are a lot of benefits to renting. And again, there are a lot of benefits to owning a house. I don't want to say that no one should ever buy a house. There are a lot of benefits to buying a house that go beyond the investment. For example, when I moved to Amherst, Massachusetts 9 years ago, my wife and I could not find a house that we could rent that would allow us to have our dog. And living with my dog was much more important to me than my long-term investment. So we bought a house. Mm-hmm. Many people enjoy living in a house that they own more than living in a house that they rent. They feel more psychologically secure. Those are all good reasons to buy a house, that they don't make it a good investment. As you said, for a long time we have focused as a society, and our politicians have focused on the benefits of buying a house, the ones I just mentioned, the fact that you can remodel it, the idea, which is not particularly well proven, that people who own houses are better citizens and better neighbors. We have not focused on the benefits of renting. And as you mentioned, one of the ones at the top of the list is that if you need a new job, if you need to move someplace else to take care of a relative, you can do it quickly without the hassle and the cost of selling your house. Houses are a very illiquid asset. They're hard to get out of, hard to turn into cash. And that's one of the downsides of owning a house.
Well, let's take a look at that thinking. And, you know, it's much deeper than you've just said. Yes, there was the thinking that home ownership meant more attachment to community. Of course, you ask people in, big cities who love to rent, and they'll say they're attached to their communities as well. But this idea was that it was better for schools, better for all sorts of commitment to community. But at one time, it was also seen as a way to fight communism.
Exactly. You know, the idea that everybody should own a house, I think perhaps it's been in the American psyche forever, but it really is a product of the modern version, and the policies to support that are a product of the 1930s. And if you think back to the 1930s, this was a time of great social unrest. We had the Great Depression. We had 25% unemployment. And it's also a time when socialism and communism were seen as very real threats. And we think of the New Deal in the 1930s as the height of American liberalism. And it was in many ways, but at the same time, the reason we had those policies was to co-opt workers away from the Communist Party and away from from social revolution. One of the ideas was that people who have a stake in society, meaning property, are less likely to revolt against the social order. And this is part of the transformation, at least in our minds, in our ideology of America into a middle-class society. So after World War II, we created this ideal of the middle class life, which included, essentially, as people say, buying a house with a fence and a yard in the suburbs. And we had this idea that we were a nation of the middle class. We had no working class. We were a middle class nation where people owned houses. And those two concepts are really tied up together.
James Kwok funded the Baseline Scenario blog with economist Simon Johnson. More on home buying here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're rethinking the American dream of home ownership with James Kwok of the economy blog, The Baseline Scenario. He says that by and large, a home is a high-risk investment with a low return. That one reason the government started subsidizing home ownership with low mortgage rates and tax breaks on mortgage payments was to fight communism by turning workers into invested property owners. But he also says government subsidies drive home prices up by enabling owners to have more cash kicked back to spend. And also homeowners get benefits that renters don't. Well, James, let's look at this. Middle-class households average only about a $500 tax break for home ownership. That's hardly enough to drive you to run out and buy a bigger home. Wealthy people get much more of a break. But your point is what? The government is rewarding people for owning a home?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a very good point you make. The mortgage interest tax deduction is an idea that people have in their heads that makes them think it's better to buy a house. But in practice, to get a significant benefit, you have to be in a high tax bracket and you have to buy a big house. In the late 1990s, the tax deduction was extended to second houses, to vacation houses. Encouraging people to buy two houses doesn't quite fit the ideology of the middle class, but it was, and it helped push up the price of houses.
Well, so what are you saying, though? I mean, I can hear listeners saying, do not even think about touching my mortgage interest deduction, you know, my taxes. I mean, it's, for some people, it's the only one they have. So mm-hmm. what are you and others saying?
Well, my opinion is that we should phase out the mortgage interest tax reduction over some relatively long period, could be 10 years or 15 years, to cushion the impact on the housing market. But if people are upset that their taxes effectively will go up slightly, I would say we should rebate the money by, for example, increasing the earned income tax credit.
In other words, something that was a more across-the-board rebate as opposed to something that just gets kicked back to homeowners.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if our idea is that total taxes paid by the U.S. people should not go up, I would still say that we should eliminate the mortgage interest tax deduction and replace it with other tax modifications that do not overwhelmingly favor the rich. But another issue we face, right now we have unemployment that's close to 10%, and part of the problem is that people cannot get housing close to where they need to work. We have a society where a lot of the jobs are still in the city or in the inner ring of suburbs, and people have to live 1 or 2 or even 3 hours outside the city to buy an affordable house. This is in part due to the failure of our housing policy over the past 20 to 30 years. Our housing policy has been to encourage more and more people to buy houses and to buy bigger houses and to buy new houses. Instead, we should have been focused, and we should be focused, on creating affordable housing, not just cheap rentals, but just affordable rentals for low-income and middle-income people in communities that have jobs.
Well, and that will mean changing a lot of mindsets, because a lot of towns won't allow rental housing or restrict it.
That's true, and that's somewhat understandable, because over the past 50 years, as we've had this emphasis on home ownership and the idea that everyone with money should buy a house, we've had a real division in our society between owners and renters. So the general assumption, if you ask most Americans, is that if you have enough money, you buy a house, and if you don't, you rent. And as a result, a lot of communities, as you say, don't want to have rental multi-unit buildings in their towns. There are a couple of exceptions to this. One of them is Manhattan, where it is so expensive that there are many affluent professionals who choose to rent. In the long term, what I would like to see is in every community, or most communities, we have good units that you can buy if you want to own, and we have good units that you can rent.
So, James Kwok, you join other analysts who are now saying that buying a home is, in fact, maybe not a way to build wealth, except in some circumstances. You know, there are going to be some places where some addresses that are always going to increase a little bit. But by and large, maybe it's not when you take into account things like inflation. So maybe not a way to build wealth, but it's still hard to wrap our brains around the idea that you still don't come out at least even. When you rent, that money goes somewhere and you never get it back. When you pay a mortgage, even if your mortgage decreases in value, you get something back.
Well, that's a very persistent argument, because it makes a lot of gut-level sense to people. They feel like if I'm renting, I'm throwing money away, which is what you always hear, whereas if I'm buying a house and paying a mortgage, I'm building equity in the house. And on one level, that's true. But there are a couple things you have to keep in mind. One is that, especially in the first 5 to 10 years of paying off a mortgage, you are actually building very little equity. Most of the money you are paying to the bank is going to pay off your interest. Another thing you have to keep in mind is what I said earlier about risk. Now, most of the time, even though housing is not such a great investment, most of the time, most people will do okay. And they will do okay because housing tends to go up. As I said, it doesn't tend to go up as much as people think it does, but it does tend to go up. And then, very importantly, you have this huge amount of leverage. You're leveraging your money 5 times or 10 times or 30 times. And that means that if housing goes up a little, your returns, after you look at the leverage, will be pretty good. But you have to balance that with the risk. And again, the risk is that housing can go down, as we've seen recently. And human beings are not very well wired to think about the trade-off between returns and risk.
And as anyone who's owned a home knows, you're not just paying the mortgage. It's a money trap.
Exactly. So there are a lot of things you have to take into account. Obviously, you have to take into account homeowner's insurance, which typically you don't pay if you're renting. You have to take into account property taxes. So as I said earlier, one reason people like to own houses is because they can do whatever they want to them. They can remodel them. They can make them exactly the way they like. That is a very good reason to buy a house as opposed to renting. You should not think of that as a good investment, though. I think, as most homeowners know, most remodelings you do, you will not get your money back when you sell your house.
Yeah, don't get me started on the new roof. That's James Kwok. He writes about his thinking that the home should not be thought of as a cash cow in the economy blog, The Baseline Scenario. He's also co-author with economist Simon Johnson of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. And one last thought, James Kwok, you end your blog posting with this very definitive thought about how homes are not going to be the cash cow anymore by saying, and by the way, if most analysts say something, it's probably not true. So what do we make of that, given the fact that many analysts are saying what you're saying now?
Well, what I would say is that for all of the kind of logical fundamental reasons, I think that housing is not a particularly good investment. As I said, I think house prices are still a little bit high. But in the history of investing, it's when everyone says you shouldn't buy something is always the time to buy something. So I'm not saying right now is the right time to buy a house, but as sentiment shifts, maybe over the next 5 to 10 years, if people actually fall out of love with their houses and house prices do fall, they may fall to the point where they will be a good investment again. I don't think they're at that point yet, but we could be going that way.
James Kwok, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, still to come, librarians fight back after the latest news here and now. Do you read the comic strip Red and Rover, the little boy sadly explaining to his very sad dog that he has to go back to school? Well, our next guest says after spending the summer playing with the kids, Rover may suffer from post-summer separation anxiety, which sounds insane unless you've also come home to a house torn apart or are sitting in an apartment next to a pooch that's barking all day. Dr. William Craig is a veterinarian and chief medical and underwriting director of Purina Care Pet Health Insurance. We'll ask him about that affiliation. He joins us from San Antonio. And Dr. Craig, lest people think this is just me and Rover, what happens to the family dog when summer ends?
Dogs are pack animals, and they're used to having company, whether it's other dogs or in most of our family cases, the human pack members that associate with them. And during the summer, the kids are out of school, maybe mom and her dad are teachers, and so they're at home. And the dogs get very comfortable having lots of pack members around all day long, and then bang, one day, all of the human pack members are gone. The poor dog is home alone and doesn't know what to do. And then that security that comes from the pack association oftentimes can drive them to an anxiety panic type of behavior. One is continuous, constant vocalization, howling, whining, barking, crying. Second category is inappropriate elimination, nervous diarrhea, urination, perhaps vomiting. And then the third category, which is the one that's maybe the big concern, is destructive behavior like ripping up the carpet, tearing apart pillows on couches, turning over furniture, totally out of their control.
It's awful to see. You know, Temple Grandin, the animal scientist, was just on the program, and she talked about, you know, how if people really care about animals like cows or horses, what about your dogs that you leave at home alone? And there are videos online. People have set up cameras, and you can see just how horrible it is that, you know, what these dogs do to themselves and their environment because they get so anxious.
Sure. And you can think of someone perhaps that has claustrophobia that's closed into a small room and they just break out into a panic. Mm-hmm. The key is to recognize that this is abnormal, psychologically driven behavior, that the pet is not doing this to get even because they've been left at home alone.
So what do we do to prevent it?
Well, things to do really revolve around desensitization. So letting the pet know that it's okay to be by yourself and that the pack is going to come back. Leave the house for short periods of time and immediately come back so that the pet realizes that, okay, they're gone, but they're going to be back in a little while. And gradually increase those amounts of time that you're gone. The second thing is avoid the ritualistic kind of behavior that triggers, I'm getting ready to leave and I won't be back for 8 or 10 hours. So things like getting your car keys out and jingling them, putting on your jacket or sweater, that starts the anxiety building up and the attack occurring. And the other thing is you don't want to reward inappropriate behavior with consolation and positive reinforcement.
So in other words, if a dog does start whining or crying when a child leaves, that's not the time to give them a treat.
Yes. And you actually don't want to make the departure into a big scene. You don't want to say, oh, it's okay, Poopy, mommy's got to go to work, but I'll be back later. Just go about your business and leave.
You also say if all else fails, behavior modification might work. You might need a trainer to come in and work with them. But also, you say, for pets with very severe stress, medications are available. Now, this raises a question. As you well know, you work for Purina Care Pet Health Insurance, and a cynic might say, oh, this is just another ginned-up illness so that somebody can sell my pet medication. What do you say to that?
Well, I say watch those videos that you were talking about. After 30 years in private practice, it's been within the last 10 years or so that these anti-anxiety medications have been available for dogs. And these are not a cure, but it is a bridge to help relieve the anxiety while you go through the behavior modification process. The medications will not do the job by themselves.
That's Dr. William Craig, a veterinarian and chief medical and underwriting director of Purina Care Pet Health Insurance. Dr. Craig, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Again, we know it sounds crazy, but we also know some of you were taking notes. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. A Fox TV reporter in Chicago ignited a firestorm this summer when she asked the question, are libraries necessary or a waste of taxpayer money? She noted that Chicago's libraries are busy, but they cost the city $120 million a year, money she said could go to struggling schools, for instance. And Fox also took a hidden camera into the huge Harold Washington Library Center and found that most of the visitors were on computers, not at the stacks, which some young people may not even know is where books are kept. Chicago's Library Commissioner Mary Dempsey was outraged, pointing out that public libraries serve more people than any other organization in town, and the hidden cameras didn't show the active stacks. Well, joining us are two library consultants. George Needham is a library strategist, and Joan Fry Williams calls herself a library futurist. We want to ask you both to weigh in on the debate, but let's start with you, Joan.
Well, we're looking at a situation that is typical of any time when government funding is reduced. People are looking for economies, and all departments, including libraries, are subject to that examination. I think the Fox piece was a little bit disingenuous. They set up their cameras in a storage part of the library stacks rather than a public section. But their question is a reasonable one. Why are we investing in this, and what kind of money should it be costing us based on what kind of return? I think Mary Dempsey made a good case for the sorts of reasons people want libraries and use libraries today, but it's a good discussion.
Well, make that case for us. Jim Tobin of the group National Taxpayers United of Illinois told Fox that libraries are pretty much obsolete. So remind us of what Commissioner Dempsey said and what people say who support libraries.
Well, I think it's really interesting that he would say they were obsolete. All you have to do is take a look and see how busy the public libraries in the United States are right now to realize that they're not obsolete at all. And I think there's also this sort of idea that a library is nothing but a warehouse of books. I think that idea went out the window years ago, if it was ever true in the first place.
And just to be clear, though computer access is lively, it is still not the majority usage of library facilities, and probably by a factor of about 10 in terms of transactions. There are far more materials transactions than there are computer sessions. The point here is not the medium that's used or that one medium should rule all the others. The point is what kind of community outcomes do you get for your investment. Now, children need to learn. What materials we use so that children can learn is a moving target. That changes no matter what our circumstances are. But the mission stays the same. We're just talking about a change of technique here.
Well, and in fact, Commissioner Dempsey makes the point, as do others, that yes, people are coming in and using the internet, and they're using it to do things like get jobs, which is always good for the community.
There's been a lot of work in libraries, public libraries especially, over the last couple of years, as the library is part of the economic engine in the community. Part of that is helping people find jobs. Another part of it is helping entrepreneurs get started. Plus, libraries generally have higher bandwidth than most people have at home, so they're able to do more with the bandwidth that's available in the library. So libraries are a vital part of the economic life of any community.
And Joan Fry Williams, what else is happening in libraries that we don't think about? If you just think, well, it's just about books and stacks, what are you missing?
What we're missing is the transformation in the people who use the service. If you think of the library as the grocery store, a lot of stuff on the shelves that you would select from and leave, that's one image, and I think that's a very limited image. We're not the grocery store. We're the kitchen. It's where things happen, where people make things, where ideas are created, where learning happens, where connections are made. in ways that do not happen when you're all alone facing a computer screen anywhere.
We're told there's English as second language classes, after-school programs, so things going on in the library that you might not think about.
That's absolutely true. Literacy training, services to any kind of community group who needs a meeting space and resources to support their meeting. We have all manner of learning activities. This is the home of free choice learning. Mm-hmm. This is the one place that isn't teaching to the test.
I live in Columbus, Ohio, and one of the things that the public library has done there is help settle a huge number of asylum seekers from Somalia. And the public library has been one of the first government agencies that these folks have an interaction with. It's a place where they can go voluntarily, where they can learn more about the English language, about American society. And this is a role that you would never think of in a public library, and yet it is one that library has seized upon and has done very well over the last few years.
California is one of the most financially strapped states, but the California library system is hiring you to work with the county library system in rural Yreka, California. They were going to close on July 1st, but they got a six-month reprieve. So how do libraries, especially as they're being looked at to either be closed or have funds cut, how do they make themselves more streamlined, and how do they have a better use of taxpayer money?
One of the things that they have to do is get themselves aligned with the community and its values. We strongly push the idea that the library is not something that sits apart from the community. It's a vital part of the community. It cannot function properly in this environment, or probably in any environment, without having a bone-deep knowledge of what the community's vision of itself is. Another part of what we look at is, how is the library spending its time today? Are there certain legacy things that we've done traditionally that don't necessarily need to be done for a 21st century library?
I need to say here, however, that the libraries with whom we work have been squeezing out all possible inefficiencies for a time now. I think we're at the point where we're looking at some fundamental reaffirmation of the point of having a public library, and then looking at how modern techniques and technologies can make that happen.
So what are some of the things you recommend for libraries? We read about libraries in Dallas opening branches in malls or grocery stores. That's taking place in Wichita, Kansas, to get out in front of the consumer.
One of the things we've discovered in our work is that the library is not a single destination. People visit libraries as part of a round of other errands. So a library that's located near the other destinations they're heading for is more convenient and gets more use.
And one of the things that's really important is to think of the library as a two-stop destination. You go once to get the materials, you go once to return them, and that's really important to retailers. They love having a public library closely located, and then maybe that's why they're in the grocery stores and in the shopping malls that you were talking about.
Joan, if you had to say one thing that libraries needed to be conscious of, that they needed to do, what would that be?
I think all libraries today need to be very clear that the funding issues they face are not library issues only. They are community issues, and they cannot risk getting into a rivalry with other governmental departments or an adversarial relationship with the people who, in all sincerity, must cut their budgets.
Yeah, my recommendation would be to remember that this too shall pass. We need to be able to deal with this as a cycle, realize that this is a good opportunity to make needed changes, and then that we'll come out on the other side stronger if we've made those changes and paid attention to the people that we're working with and looked outside instead of inside.
That's George Needham, library strategist, Joan Fry Williams, library futurist. They run the library consultancy firm George and Joan. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, your thoughts on this or anything, just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or leave a comment right there. When we come back, the new cultural exchanges between Cuba and the U.S., Here and Now. There are small signs that relations between the U.S. and Cuba are thawing. The 48-year-old U.S. trade embargo is still in place, but President Obama did ease up on some restrictions that had been in place for Cuban Americans, allowing them to visit or send money to family on the communist island. And the administration is also thinking of easing up on travel restrictions for all Americans. And there are also signs that the arts are being used to bridge the old Cold War gap. U.S. officials are allowing the American Ballet Theatre Company to perform in Havana in November at the Havana International Ballet Festival at the Karl Marx Theatre. It's the American Ballet Theatre's first performance there since the festival was launched in 1960. Rachel Moore is the executive director of the American Ballet Theatre Company.
I can't speak for the politics, but I think we truly do believe that the arts are a tremendous bridge between communities, and dance is not is an art form that doesn't require a knowledge of language, and this is a great way to bridge between two communities that may not speak the same language.
And this artistic exchange is also going in the other direction. Earlier this year, the Cuban band Los Van Van, known as the Rolling Stones of Cuba, toured the U.S. They kicked off that tour in Miami, home to some of Fidel Castro's staunchest critics. The BBC's Maria Bacalapulo sampled opinion about U.S.-Cuban relations among the musicians in Little Havana.
Every object in the Art of Freedom Cafe kitchen is an instrument to this boisterous 55-year-old Cuban-American cook and percussionist, George Spider Hernandez.
Let me tell you, I have stories.
He says he cannot wait to perform in Cuba one day.
I don't see Cuba change seriously, and I don't really care. But if you want to call me, say, Spider, you want to go? I go and play. I don't care. I don't give a damn, you know? I'll go and play, why not? If you pay me.
Do you think that a lot of people in this neighborhood are looking forward to things opening up with Cuba?
Oh yeah, of course. Every day, every time, every minute. And they don't want to let him play here, why not? Let him play here. It's good to communicate, you know? Music doesn't have to do with nothing with politics, you know?
There is stout support for America's 48-year-old trade embargo against Cuba in Little Havana, the oldest Cuban enclave in Miami. A lot of Cuban exiles condemn groups like controversial dance band Los Van Van as pro-communist. When the group played a concert in Miami in 1999, protesters took to the streets, throwing rocks and bottles. The local newspaper reported that Miami's mayor sent the musicians home. In contrast, when Los Van Van returned to Miami earlier this year, concertgoers dramatically outnumbered those protesting. It reflected the changed attitude, the shifting demographic in Miami, that the younger generation doesn't identify with the hard-line Cold War divide between the two countries.
I played Los Van Van, I played Pablo Milanés the other day, Yolanda, and we just wasn't played for the last 50 years. People say, you're crazy. I say, no.
Al Fuentes, morning radio host of one of the most popular shows on Soul 95.7 Miami, has been part of this dramatic change.
My parents left Cuba getting away from the same thing that my father doesn't want me to do. He wants to censor me and say, you can't do it. Wait a minute, you left there because they didn't let you do what you want. Let's let the listeners decide. And 99.9% of the people want to hear the music they grew up with. I hate to say it, but Cubans that live here, we are the most prejudiced against Cubans. Cubans do not support Cubans that were from Cuba, and that's wrong. It's our culture. Why we lost our country, we're going to lose that too. We have to keep it alive. And I'm the one that's doing that here. And I have no regrets.
He also pushes the point with the guests he has on his show, including the daughter of Juan Formel, the band leader of Los Van Van. Singer Vanessa Formel came from Cuba 16 years ago. She is eager to go back and play in Cuba.
I don't like when they put a government there and they left. That's not my fault. The only thing that I can say is that I miss my people. I miss the places where I grew up, you know, so I want to go there. I want to see those people. I want to sing for those people.
What do they say here when you say you want to go to Cuba?
Oh, that I'm a communist.
Cuban exiles in Little Havana come to the Oikomo Ayer Club, mostly for the nostalgia. Lime and rum mojito cocktails are in constant flow as people sing along to a music video with the great Celia Cruz. The club's name translates to today like yesterday. The club's owner is young and stylish. His name is Fabio. He prefers not to give his last name, thinking he might suffer some backlash for his views. His father was a political prisoner, and they fled when Fabio was 5. He's been back to Cuba just once, and it was emotional for him.
I respect the people who are lying on the sea. I respect all the political prisoners that are in prison right now and the ones that are here but was prisoned years ago.
So you don't think they should come here? Los Van Van, Silvio Rodriguez?
No, to Miami, no. United States is a huge country, and Van Van can go to any other city in United States, but Miami is from Cuba. If you go to the history, the culture, the music, this, the way that people show how they feel, their life, the music represents everything.
Club Hoy Como Ayer is full tonight. The mostly Cuban-American crowd is here to see Ay Mi Nubiola. She escaped Cuba and came to Miami via Mexico to pursue her music career. Her mother is still there, and she says she's tired of the animosity towards Cuba.
For me, it was something like, it's something like when you love something too much and you can't have. You feel hungry, you feel sad, you feel unhappy, lonely. It's not good because you don't have your soul clean, no? That I understand now. Sometimes I...
Okay. Take your time.
It's not good for the people in Cuba. Somebody have to start. Young generation change old generations. The people don't want to continue with the separate of families. Cuba from Cuba, Cuban from Miami, Cuban from... No, Cuban is everybody.